Joining me by phone is Professor Paul Ehrlich, Ph.D. Dr. Ehrlich is the Bing Professor of Population Studies in the Department of Biological Sciences at Stanford University, and he's also president of Stanford's Center for Conservation Biology. Dr. Ehrlich and his wife, Anne Ehrlich, co-authored the seminal 1968 bestseller, The Population Bomb, and also collaborated in January of this year on a paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society titled, Can a Collapse of Global Civilization Be Avoided? Dr. Ehrlich was one of the founders of Zero Population Growth and is co-founder of the Millennium Alliance for Humanity and the Biosphere with his wife, Anne. Dr. Ehrlich, welcome to KGNU.
Nice to be here.
Good to have you indeed. During our time together today, I hope to discuss, in general, the effects of human population on climate, the environment, food security, and our overall quality of life. But first, can we take a moment to compare and contrast the world environment of 2013 with that of 1968 when your book, The Population Bomb, first came out? What kind of increases in population have we experienced since then, and how significant have the losses to habitat, biodiversity, and our own quality of life been since then?
Well, there were about 3.5 billion people on the planet in 1968, and somewhere around 500 million people were probably hungry. Now there's about, we're pushing 7.1 billion, which means we have added something like 3.5 billion people in that period. And the population has basically doubled since the writing of the Population Bomb. That's many more people. When I was born in 1932, there were only 2 billion people alive. So we have seen an incredible increase in the size of the human population, followed by, of course, or accompanied by an incredible decrease in the number of other organisms on the planet. The working parts of our life support systems have been decimated by our own growth, and that's why you hear so many issues about why food is getting more expensive, why we're having trouble with pollinators, and so on. We've now got close to 1 billion people hungry, and another 2 billion at least micronutrient malnourished, leading to blindness in some, and in general, inability to perform the way people ought to perform. So what we've seen is sadly, a dramatic worsening of our situation. It turns out in retrospect that the Population Bomb was much too optimistic a book. And we're now paying the price of having done basically nothing about it. The only really good news in the whole mess is that at least in rich countries, birth rates have been dropping and rather dramatically. And that's heading us in the right direction, but we're still scheduled to add, if you believe the UN projections, about another 2.5 billion people by 2050, and then more after that. The U.S. is the most overpopulated nation in the world, and we're one of the rich countries that's still growing rapidly.
You've mentioned quite a few things in my notes here that I hope to address during our time together, and that's great. But backing up just a little bit, I wanted to ask, what is the planet's long-term carrying capacity in general? And is our current population size, you mentioned 7.1 billion, is that 7.1 billion, the way we live now, sustainable, especially in a style many North Americans are accustomed to?
No, one can go to a website called, I think if you just put into Google ecological footprint, you can find the data. But to maintain the population size we have now in anything like almost nothing is essentially permanently sustainable. But if you want to sustain today's population size over the long term with the kind of lifestyle that's led by most Americans, you need 4 or 5 additional planets. If you wanted to sustain today's population at today's lifestyles, that is, with roughly half the population living in misery, you'd still need at least another half planet to do it. So we're way, way beyond the long-term carrying capacity. And the studies that we've done indicate under fairly optimistic assumptions that you might manage to support 1.5 or 2 billion people over a relatively long time if you behaved well. But we're a long way from that, and of course, we're not moving towards a sustainable population. We're moving further from a sustainable population now.
So would it be fair to suggest then that science and biologists in general would consider maybe 2 billion to be optimal or sustainable over the life of the planet, 2 billion human beings? Is that kind of a target we're looking for?
Yeah, 1.5 to 2 billion. It depends on how much safety you want. Because, for example, when something comes along like the discovery that we were destroying the ozone layer, you can change from what looks like a safe number to a very unsafe number very rapidly. But 1.5 or 2 billion would be a number to shoot for, at least for the next couple hundred years. And you'll know a lot more science, hopefully, if you keep the society together for the next couple of hundred years, and you'll be able to adjust your targets as time goes along. We're so far from a sustainable population that we know, the scientific community knows, that we've got to start humanely reducing our population size as soon as we can possibly do it. So the sooner the better. And that'll take a long time. And during that time, we can have a long discussion of what the targets ought to be.
Just a moment ago, you mentioned the United States is grossly overpopulated. And I'm aware it's the third most populated country behind China and India. What kind of message does the United States send to the rest of the world when we have a population of 320 million people mostly living in affluence at this time? Isn't the message, live like us, achieve what we've achieved?
Yeah, well, that's the unfortunate message. The worst message is that India and China both recognize that they have serious population problems, and both have tried at various times and in various ways to do something about it, China with substantial success. But the U.S. doesn't even realize it, doesn't discuss it. You can imagine what would happen to Obama if he told Americans that they were an overpopulated nation, even though no one has ever come up with an even semi-sane idea for why there ought to be more than 120 million Americans alive at one time. As we're pushing on three times the maximum anybody could imagine an excuse for having. If you want to have the maximum number of Americans live, of course, you want to have a sustainable population, maybe 100 million or so, and keep the pod nation going for several million years instead of adding continuously and see the nation dissolve in this century. But here we are, and again, we're the most world's most overpopulated nation, because although there are two nations with more people, when you multiply in, as you have to, our consumption patterns, that makes us vastly more overpopulated than India and even China.
Related to this, a number of years ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing University of Colorado physics professor Al Bartlett about population issues. During the 90s, Dr. Bartlett presented what he called the Great Challenge by asking if there was any area of human endeavor on any scale whose long-term solution is in any way demonstrable, I'll get that out, if we add or assisted or advanced with more people. In other words, Dr. Bartlett was asking in the 90s, is there any way that we can benefit from any increase in population, more scientists, more engineers, more computer programmers? Is there any benefit at this point?
None whatsoever. Quite the opposite. I mean, Al Bartlett has been a hero in pointing out to people something that, for example, our government could learn, that nothing physical can grow at rates in perpetuity. In other words, when you hear the president's chief guy say, we got to get back to 3.5% or 4% growth a year, what he's saying is, I don't understand a thing about mathematics. I can't even do exponential growth. I don't understand anything. I'm an innumerate idiot. But, of course, people don't read it that way. And the idea that you need more people to have more engineers, more Einsteins, and so on. First of all, if the number of people gives you engineers and Einsteins, why aren't the Arab countries so much more advanced than the Israelis? Obviously, if you want to have more engineers, more Einsteins, and so on, we ought to be giving full rights to all our minorities and giving them excellent education. We ought to be doing the same thing for women, giving women more education, equal education with men, equal job opportunities with men, equal rights with men, equal freedom from abuse with men around the world would, first of all, give us many more engineers, Einsteins, and so on, because we'd have the right conditions to develop those people. And second of all, when you give women those rights and you give them and all sexually active human beings access to modern contraception and backup abortion, you saw possibly that would be an entire solution to the population problem. In other words, if we did that, we might very well get birth rates down to the point where eventually the global population began to shrink, which is what we need. By the way, let me also say, if you keep the population growing, you may end up with a few more Einsteins and a few more Hitlers and a few more Stalins. That is one of the most preposterous arguments for population growth anybody has ever come up with. And people who say those sorts of things really need to take off their shoes to count up to 20 and think about the problems.
Your comments about women in general are really appropriate considering March 8th is International Women's Day worldwide. But why is it that we can empower women and that results in a lower birth rate? What's that all about? What's the connection?
Well, first of all, this isn't something that's theoretical, it's empirical. That is, when we've done it, that's what's happened. But I think you can see that when a woman has, for example, an opportunity to do a useful job or have one more baby, or if she has the opportunity to be able to not walk to work anymore but go on a bike, and she has the money to buy a bike or she has the money to have one more child, the choices are fairly obvious. The other thing is that I think women care much more about the world in which their children are going to live. They understand that it isn't just the number of children that a person wants. It's what kind of world do you want those children to live in, and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. And women tend to care more, I think, for future generations, and that's what the trade-off is. As many people have pointed out, our generation is stealing from the future. We are now, as Michael Clare has said in his brilliant book, The Race After What's Left, we're in a situation where we're going for scarcer and scarcer resources in more difficult places, more dangerous to extract. We're in a race for the last, and the people who are not going to get the last are going to be the future generations.
Reviewing a lot of your writing in preparation for our time together, I noted that food security has been a long-time concern in your work, and you were recently quoted as saying, we still only have a 10% chance of averting starvation-caused collapse of civilization. What would such a collapse look like? How and why would a place like the U.S. collapse when it's obvious at the moment we're so capable of food production on our own?
Well, first of all, it could change very rapidly in the United States as we see the climate changing around us. One has to remember that, first of all, agriculture is utterly dependent on climate, and our agricultural system evolved in a period which in the history of Earth was one of the most favorable for agriculture that we've ever seen. And, of course, we are now changing that very rapidly, as is clear to everybody. So it's not even clear that we'll be all that secure in the United States. But, for example, where you can't really predict, let's suppose that the melting of the so-called Himalayan ice tower, which is a source of important agricultural water for China, India, and Pakistan, leads to a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, just a small one. The most recent studies, Turco et al., show that even a small nuclear war between India and Pakistan, which many Indians and Pakistanis would like to have, I'm sorry to say, would destroy us. So that's one way it could go. Another way, more people you have, the bigger the chances of a vast epidemic. Another way it could go, or if neither of those things happen, if we turn out to be lucky there and there's no more water wars, there's no more resource wars and so on, then it will just be a steady downgrade of the availability of food, the ability to transport ourselves, the climate increasing to the point, as some people have been arguing very recently, to the point where you can't work outside for much of the time in most parts of the earth. In other words, we are possibly going to go to a 7 or 8 or 9 degrees Celsius warming if we don't start doing something about controlling our carbon emissions seriously. And when you have that, you're going to make the planet totally incapable of supporting anything like the number of people we have today. And your guess is as good as mine as to what kind of social action that will lead to.
I promise you we're going to try to address some solutions towards the end of our time together, but you mentioned...
I'm not trying to cheer everybody up.
Okay. You mentioned a moment ago China's efforts to control its population, and I think you mentioned India as well, but do we have a sense in general of how people and other governments around the world view population issues? In China, there was a strict enforcement to a one-child policy, with India at times trying to devise voluntary programs to curb family size. Yet in places like Japan, Russia, and even Germany, those governments are trying to devise incentives for parenthood.
The inevitable happens. That is, when you have a growing population and you slow it down, the proportion of people in it who are older tends to increase, and the proportion that are young tend to decrease. That's absolutely inevitable. It's arithmetic, and all you have to do is plan for it. You know, they say, oh, my God, it's terrible. We're going to have more 70-year-olds. And therefore, we're going to have to support, the working people are going to have to support them. They never mention that you're going to have fewer seven-year-olds, and the working people won't have to support them. You're going to have fewer people in the criminal age classes. They don't mention that 70-year-olds, I hear the rumor, can be totally functional economically if they need to be. In other words, almost all the arguments for incentives to increase the birth rate so that you have fewer, relatively fewer old people are moronic. They are, as my colleague John Hart calls them, spherically senseless. They're senseless from any point of view that you look at them. The change is purely a function of arithmetic. The only way you can avoid it totally is to keep the population growing forever. And if you think you can have a population that grows forever, then you need to be institutionalized and get help.
Certainly. Filmmaker Sir David Attenborough was quoted in The Telegraph this January as saying humans are a plague on the earth and that if we don't limit our population growth, nature will do it for us. His take seemed to be that not only are we destroying the lovely world he's been able to present to us in his broadcast, but that we're simply running out of the physical space needed to grow the food for our enormous horde, to quote him directly.
Well, it's also, of course, that we're killing off the other organisms that he has shown us so well that are the working parts of our life support system. For example, if we lose the predators that control our crop pests, and we're in the process of doing that, we will not be able to maintain agriculture because we can't do it. Many people think, oh, we'll just use pesticides, but the bugs get resistant to the pesticides very fast, and if we keep using more and more, we'll get us and not the bugs. They can evolve resistance at many, many times the rate that human beings could. So we're utterly dependent on the organisms that Attenborough has done such a marvelous job of showing us, and yet we're wiping them out, and we are, as he points out, running out of land, deteriorating the land we're already farming because our agricultural system is not designed for long term. It's designed for short term profits in the rich countries, at least. And so he's absolutely right. There's no scientific dispute about this. You can read the statements made by the scientific community. For instance, in 1993, all the academies of science got together and said, if we don't solve the population problem, we're screwed. In the same year, the Union of Concerned Scientists brought out the World Scientists Warning to Humanity, which was signed by more than half the Nobel laureates in science, saying exactly the same thing. And none of this is new. The big issue and what we're working on in the MOB, in the Millennium Alliance for Humanity in the Biosphere, is trying to figure out why we're not doing anything to solve these problems. How do you change our political system and educate our public and get rid of things like Fox News so that you can actually start moving ahead on some of the things we have to do if we're going to survive? By the way, my 10% chance of avoiding a calamity has been strongly objected to by Jim Brown, who's an energy expert and member of the National Academy and the best biogeographer in the world. And he says, I'm nuts. That actually is only about a 1% chance of us avoiding a collapse. Both of us agree, however, that it's worth working to try and make it either 11% or 1.1% because we both have grandchildren and care a lot about what happens to them.
I can appreciate that. And again, we'll take some time at the end of our discussion together to talk about options and possibilities and those kinds of things. But for those just tuning in, I'm Roger Wendell, and my guest today is Paul Ehrlich, PhD, and we're talking about population, overpopulation, the loss of biodiversity, and those kinds of issues. Dr. Ehrlich, you yourself have written that virtually every past civilization has eventually undergone collapse, a loss of socio-political economic complexity, usually accompanied by a dramatic decline in population and size. But yet, some countries, maybe China might be an example, have recovered and gone on again.
Yeah, well, China went through a collapse. One of the funny things is people kind of think of China often as an underdeveloped country that's developing. But, of course, China was developed long before the United States. And except for some bad policy and unhappy events from their point of view in the early part of the 19th century, they've been a winner all the way through. Another society which also collapsed and recovered several times, it was the Egyptian society. They've lasted for some 3,000 years, but they had the wonderful advantage until they built the Aswan Dam of having their agricultural land restored every year. That's a huge advantage, which has not been had by most civilizations that have collapsed. The collapses that have occurred in the past are varied. They almost all have a big environmental component in them. The results differed. I mean, the Mayan civilization, if you've been to Tulum or someplace, some places in northeastern Mexico, you've seen what a magnificent civilization they had. But the Mayans are still around. They just don't any longer have a large, complex civilization with magnificent buildings and so on. So the collapses have been diverse. They have been all over the planet. Now, for the very first time in human history, we are confronted with a global civilization that is headed for collapse. And that's a brand new thing. And that's what scares, I think, the scientific community more than anything else. In the old days, if the Assyrians went down, the Egyptians were still going. Maybe the Hittites were still going. When Easter Island collapsed, nobody else noticed. But now it's going to be global. And one of the really frightening things is it'll be very, very difficult, if possible at all, to reestablish a modern-type civilization, because we've already used the rich resources that were available to everybody 10,000 years ago. 10,000 years ago, you could pick up copper 100% on the surface of the ground, whereas now we have to mine it at 0.5%. And if we lose technology, it's going to be very difficult to reestablish it without technology.
Some, especially on the left, have accused you of being too focused on population itself being the problem, that the concern should lie more with the distribution of resources or how people are concentrated or distributed across a region.
Well, there's no question at all that the distribution of resources is a very serious problem, and one that we have to tackle, and one that we talk about all the time. Not just the distribution of resources, but equity in general, how we treat women, how we treat minorities, and so on, all part of the problem. On the other hand, they all become moot if you let the number of people keep increasing. In other words, if you're concerned about, for instance, housing for the poor, you've got to be concerned about the size of the population, because it will tell you how many poor they're going to be, how hot it's going to be, because every additional person makes the climate warmer nowadays. If you let things go too far, there will be no way to house the rich or the poor. So it's not that those problems aren't important. You could feed everybody in the world today if you could distribute food equally on the amount that's grown, and if you didn't feed a lot of it to cattle, and if you didn't feed a lot of it to Hummers in the form of gasoline. But what sign is there? Human beings, since the agricultural revolution, have never divided anything equally. So my view is we've got to have few enough people that everybody can have a decent life, even those who get the short end of the stick, where the resources don't reach them in the same quantity they reach the people in more powerful positions. And the equity issues are extremely important. In the United States, the Republican Party has had this wonderful success at redistributing wealth over the last 30 years or so, taking money from, the Hood-Robin principle. They take money from the poor and keep it themselves. And if we keep that up, the social situation is going to be so bad, it's unlikely we'll be able to get together to do anything about the coming collapse.
A topic certainly of interest for an entire different interview, indeed.
Indeed.
Dr. Ehrlich, though, why is it we're not hearing more about population issues from our government, in the schools, or even many of the larger environmental organizations? Simply, I don't hear much about any concern for population.
People are scared of the issue. There was in the early population movement, and just like in everything else in our society, an element of racism. People don't want to be accused of being racist, particularly when they're not. And of course, there's the unfortunate thing. I be very careful to say that the population problem is in no way a Catholic problem. Catholics perform basically the same way non-Catholics do in the same economic situation. They use abortion a little bit more than non-Catholics. But the Catholic hierarchy has been incredibly immoral, incredibly nasty in trying to fight politically to prevent anything being done about population or being even mentioned. They failed in places like India and France, like Italy and France, where the birth rates in those Catholic countries are much lower than the United States. But they've been very successful in paralyzing politicians in the United States. Imagine what would happen to Obama if he said what he very well knows, and that is that the U.S. is overpopulated and it's one of our worst problems. But you don't dare say it in our society, or at least people are afraid to say it, despite what we now know about the Catholic hierarchy.
And again, focusing on our society, at times it almost seems as though the media glorifies or encourages large families. I'm thinking of recent examples like Sarah Palin's five children during her run for the VP slot, or the Octomoms, I'll get that right, 14 children, or the Duggards hoping for their 20th child. Newsweek recently ran a piece asking, where have all the babies gone? And a new book, What to Expect When No One's Expecting, has been gaining a lot of attention and raising concern that we won't have enough young people to sustain our economy, as we talked about earlier, or keep Social Security payments flowing to the elderly. So in summary, the media seems to be promoting this idea of bigger families and ignoring population issues.
Well, of course, the media has been firing the mainstream media has been firing reporters steadily there, and mostly they're reporters who know anything about science or anything about the environment. And, you know, it was interesting that while the head of the Sierra Club and the U.S.'s most prominent climate scientists and so on were breaking the law to bring the whole issue of climate change to public attention a couple of weeks ago.
Right, a first.
The main story
Sierra
in the media was some South African athlete who presumably had shot his girlfriend, and that didn't cover the fact that our top climate scientist in the U.S. government is so scared of what's coming that he's been arrested several times and was being arrested again. I mean, don't get me. I've been a member of the media. I used to be a correspondent for NBC News. We could all tell us stories about the media, but it's wrecked. It's broken. Nobody in the media is well informed of what's going on, just like the politicians. And so, you know, you're a rare item, and you're not the anchor on the evening news, unfortunately.
Thank you.
I'm happy to vote for you.
I appreciate that. Okay, well, pointing in that direction, then, as far as solutions and moving the right way, what are some immediate steps that the current administration should or could be taking? And what can be done to get the United Nations, say, for example, and other countries around the world moving in the right direction as far as population issues? What should they be doing? What could they be doing? What should Obama do?
Well, the first thing Obama is going to get a chance to do that will be really big in the general environmental area, of course, is to stop that pipeline that's going to help destroy the United States. So that would be an immediate step with Kerry to do it. I wish he'd have the guts to get up there and start talking about the population problem, just like it's discussed in other countries. For instance, if you go to Australia, they have an ongoing debate about how big the population ought to be in Australia. I was in China as a guest of their academy for a couple of weeks. Ann and I went, and the attitude on population is just uniform. We've got to stop our population growth and start a decline as fast as we can, because they have horrendous population problems that they recognize. So the United States is way behind on this. I would think that Obama might invite a bunch of people from other countries to come and explain to the United States how we're setting a hideous example for the world and the things we could do. And obviously what we should do is make sure that contraception is available to everybody as cheaply as possible, to say that no corporation, doesn't matter what their background is, everybody has to have the same access to health care, and that has to be access to contraception and to good contraception. There has to be backup abortion for everybody, which we don't have now. And those are many steps could be taken by the U.S. government, but the political costs for whoever tries to take them will be very large, because we have a almost totally uneducated public, and we have huge elements dedicated to keeping them uneducated. I mean, the climate denier movement, the Koch brothers and so on, they fund, there's roughly 30 times the money going into trying to destroy the U.S. by having climate change wreck us as there is going forward to try and get us to do something about it. So we have that's why the mob is basically trying to start a ground-up movement, and there are other outfits like 350.org and so on that are trying to generate a ground-up movement. That's why 50,000 people went to Washington and many in San Francisco also to protest that we're not doing anything about climate change. But even there, most of those people have not had called to their attention the fact that the larger the population gets, the more greenhouse gases go into the atmosphere. And there are a whole series of scientific papers on this, but they're ignored. So we've got a lot of work to do. And one of the things we can do is go on the radio and rave about it like I'm doing now.
Fair enough. Unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot of time left together, but I wanted to ask you to predict the future, and I know that's difficult. But
I'm often wrong. If I could really predict the future, I would be buying low, selling high, and will have by this time bought Bora Bora and be living there.
Me too as well. But the year 2050 seems to be a pivotal point in the future of biology. What does the future of civilization look like to you at this point for the year 2050?
So I'm enormously concerned. I have great-grandchildren who are all under three, and they're going to be, you know, they're going to be in their 40s then, and I hope they can live anything, something like what we would consider a decent life, but I have severe doubts. It's going to depend on a lot of things that are very difficult to predict. There are a lot of uncertainties. One of the cheery things is that we know from history that when the time is ripe, human societies can change with lightning speed. We know, for example, that our consumption patterns can change almost instantly from our experience in the Second World War, where we did change our consumption patterns, first in one direction and then back again in a period of 5 or 6 years, and we did it totally. So we could change very, very rapidly when the time is ripe. We could start treating women decently, give everybody contraception and access to abortion, doing all the things we need to do very suddenly, just as things went very rapidly in 1989 when the Soviet Union blessedly disappeared and the wall came down and so on. So when the time is ripe, human beings can act very, very rapidly and in the right directions. The issue is, how do we ripen the time? That's what we've all got to work to do. That's why you should go to mahb.stanford.edu and sign up to figure out how to do it and get it done.
And speaking of time, we're almost out of it. What are some good ways for listeners to learn more, in addition to the website you just gave us, about your work in general? And what are ways people can become more involved to make a difference and help move society in the right direction? What can Joe and Jane Sixpack do at this point?
Well, we're all social animals, and what you can do is join any organization that's trying to fix up the environment, trying to give better rights to minorities, trying to give more rights to women, push on your congressman to pass the I think it's the Violence Against Women Act that's coming up now. And if you go to the website, there's lots and lots of books. You can find all sorts of stuff to read. A book that Ann and I wrote a couple years ago called The Dominant Animal is easily available on the web. And covers most of this stuff. And none of it is mysterious. So the best thing to do is get involved. Put 10% of your time into learning about the situation that we're in and doing something that will give your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren a better world to live in.
Give us that website one more time.
mahb.stanford.edu. We're mobsters, but it's MAHB. .stanford.edu. And it's scientists and people in the general public and so on trying to get together to figure out how to do this, to call people's attention to the drivers of overpopulation and overconsumption and the problems of inequity, and get everybody talking to each other and working together to solve the problem. If you're waiting for the politicians to solve it for you, you got a long wait coming.
Excellent. Dr. Ehrlich, thank you for your time on KGNU today.
It's my great pleasure. Take care.
My guest has been Dr. Paul Ehrlich, author of The Population Bomb and president of Stanford Center for Conservation Biology. If you'd like to comment on this program or anything else you've heard on KGNU, you can do so by calling our comment line at 303-447-9911, where your comments are played back every Tuesday morning here on KGNU. Again, thank you for supporting your community radio station. For KGNU, I'm Roger Wendell.